You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today, I'm talking with Benjamin about 8 steps to make a smart decision. Have you already joined the Effective Statistician LinkedIn group? Awesome. Well done. You see a lot of more content coming there. So if you haven't, then head over to LinkedIn, search for the Effective Statistician group and join. You can also follow me on LinkedIn because I'm quite regularly on LinkedIn and post a lot of additional things there that help you to be more effective and more impactful at work. This podcast is produced in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. The reduced rate is just £20 for non-high-income countries and £95 for high-income countries annually, of course. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSA activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of the Effective Statistician, and this time it's again Benjamin and myself. Hi Benjamin, how are you doing?
Hi Alexander, very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah.
Everything fine?
The new normal. We are recording this just a couple of days into our enhanced social distancing or something like this in Germany.
Yeah, the coronavirus has come all over us.
And of course, this will be get published a little bit later down the in the year, but feels quite interesting.
Yeah, it does. It's...
Okay, but that's not the topic for today. Topic for today is about making good decisions. And I think this is a really, really interesting topic. And the way we will talk about it today is really about decision-making in general and what we can do about it. So it applies to whether you move your house or whether, well, you're maybe not a house, but maybe whether you move into a house, buy a house, buy a flat, whether you buy a car, whether you go for a new job, or, you know, all kind of different things you can run through this framework, which is based on decision science. And so I think this will be a really, really nice episode today that is, helps to get clarity in your mind when it comes to decision making. Because the usual way we do it is not that effective.
Well, it's something that we are used to. I mean, it's quite straightforward. I mean, usually you start discussing, so debating, then, you know, you meet people, you know, you get decisions sometimes not. You move on with more meetings with other stakeholders, and then you start creating PowerPoints. So sending back and forth, it's the usual way.
And you know, and more and more discussions, and you have side discussions in the hallways, and you have email chains and all kind of different things. And then there's this approaching deadline where you need to make a decision.
Time pressure is all those.
And then you need to come make a decision. And is that actually a good way to get to a decision? I'm not sure. I think there is a lot of waste there. There's not a lot of effectiveness in there because you get conflicting feedback. You don't get it in, you know, the right way. You don't have a clear communication path. And
sometimes you don't even know what the problem is.
Yep. Yeah.
and you go around in circles and circles and circles.
So, I mean, you may have a goal in terms of saying, well, that's where we need to get to. But actually, what is actually the problem that we're trying to solving here? So it doesn't sound very, very efficient. But actually, I mean, what is then the best or the approach that you suggest? Or maybe would you say it's rather like a completely different approach, or maybe just organizing some of the pieces that we just discussed? I mean, for example, just, you know, when you debate, making sure that the problem is, you know, put on a spot, so really that we identified the problem. So what would be your suggestion then?
So the suggestion is not originally coming from me. There's a really, really nice book called Smart Choices, A Practical Guide to Making Better Decisions. This book was already published quite a while ago and becomes a framework in lots of different areas, including also the benefit risk area. So if you look into the EMA guidelines, into various IMI projects, they refer to this pro-actuarial approach, which we will talk about a little bit in a minute, what that means. And this framework helps you to make they're good decisions. Of course, there it's applied to benefit risk decision, and we can talk a little bit about that. But it is a general approach that you can use for any decisions. And as you said, the first part in this PROACT URL, the P and the R, actually stand for problem. And the first step is to get really crystal clear on the problem, what you're trying to solve, and to have an agreement on what the problem is that you're trying to solve.
that actually is already the first biggest problem, to find the problem, because usually you just, you know, identify what's not working and trying to get around it in a way. So to, you know, you think you identified the problem by knowing what's not working well, or, you know, what the goal is basically. So, but actually I think it's quite important to really take a step back. Try to look from outside, or just from the general approach, bigger picture, let's say, into the whole discussion, into the problem. So not only see, you know, already think that you identified the problem and then move forward, but really, you know, take a step back, look into this and try to objectively identify what the real problem is. And I think that's already the first very, very difficult step, because we all kind of, you know, we are mentally already into the problem. We think we already know what the problem is, and then we just move on.
And we also agree everybody understands what the problem is. And
absolutely.
So I think that's an interesting point. One of the often mistakes that I see is that you get proposed a solution. Yeah, so let's say you get a job offer or something like this. You see advertisement for, you know, a nice car or whatever. And then your problem that you think about is, do I go for this job offer, yes or no? But of course, that's not really the problem. The underlying problem is, do I want to grow my income, or do I want to develop myself? Do I want to have a good career? And then, of course, these are the more underlying problems.
Yeah. Also just the negative side sometimes is, you know, when you look out for a job, so maybe what's wrong with my current job?
Can I do about that?
So it's like there's something that you don't feel good about and think, so the problem is really not accepting the other job or buying a new car. So, but what is actually the reason why I think about it?
Yeah, the same is in clinical research. Yeah, you may want to just look into whether you run the study, but maybe the bigger problem you're trying to solve is to optimize a portfolio. Yeah, and maybe you just focus on the right dose selection when you should look into, does it actually make sense to move forward at all with these doses? Not just dose selection A, B, or C, but maybe dose selection A, B, or C, or recommendation to cancel the further development with this product, or get back to the drawing board and come up with an alternative formulation here, or maybe come up with a new study where we look into other dosings. Yeah. So there's a going back to the drawing board and having a bigger picture helps you make sure that you understand the problem. And then there's a meeting comes into place where you can, you know, agree on the problem statement and make sure that everybody has the same viewpoint there.
And only after realizing what the problem is, you go into the next step, which we usually say is the problem.
Yeah.
The objective.
Yeah.
So it's about the question. So what do we want to achieve?
Yeah.
So that is where we usually start. So we don't, you know, it's or not, I wouldn't say usually, but it's quite often that we start with, you know, just looking into what do we want to achieve and not what is the problem, what would we like to involve.
Yeah. So there it comes really when we come into the job offer, of course, it comes like things like the financial side of things, career development, maybe the commuting time, home office policies, what, you know, all these kind of different features that you can look into that describes that problem. If you think about therapies, then it's about, you know, what are all the benefits, what are all the risks, what are all kind of non-medical things in it, like access to the therapy or the cost of the therapy. These kind of things then play a role in the in benefit risk or therapy decision making. Yeah. One important thing to think about, especially from a benefit risk point of view, is that we should avoid double counting here. So variables that are highly correlated to each other, pick the most important one and just look into this rather than having 10 highly correlated variables with each other, and then you get the perception, wow, this is really, really important. But in essence, you're counting the same thing just 10 times.
Yeah, I think that's quite clear. I mean, everyone had the experience of, you know, when you go out and have too many objectives, too many settings, that's not going to work. So if you have to focus.
Yeah.
That's bringing you down to one. I mean, you may have several objectives or you may have several problems, but then you have to divide it. So you can't just take them into one discussion. You can take them all. So you may put two together or you may, you know, add something to one of the problems or objectives. But in reality, I mean, that's what everyone expects. If you have too many of them, that's not going to work. That will confuse, bring too many people, too many shareholders in, bring too many things in that is just confusing and will not be efficient at all.
In benefit risk, what is very often shown is some kind of value tree. So you have then some overarching categories, let's say like treatment severity, quality of life, safety, convenience, price, and these come all together. Yeah. And then you can have within these overall categories, you can have subcategories like different symptoms for the efficacy side or different parts of quality of life and functioning or different levels of access and convenience. So that is a nice way to get all your objectives a little bit more organized. In terms of when we look into our benefit risk of our own drugs, one important thing to look into is also how it compares to the competitive landscape. So it's not just about the side effects of your drug or the key benefits of your drugs. It's also about those of the other drugs out there. So maybe with your new method of action, you have a specific side effect that you're concerned about, but then you maybe don't have side effects that other methods of actions have. Yeah. So these also need to be objectives in a way that maybe you induce that side effect, but you avoid another one. Yeah. So having this in mind as well is really important.
Yeah, I think this is coming through all the steps. It's basically these, you know, taking a step back or looking into the bigger picture that we had already in identifying the problem. Wherever you are in the past, you know, you can't just, you know, go there with, you know, very short view. So you really have to look around and see alternatives, look outside the own problem, the own company, the own area. There might be more. Maybe not. I mean, it depends on what the problem is, but you know, don't forget to look outside.
Yeah, and by the way, as we say about step one, step two, step three, of course, there could be some iterations in there, yeah, and some loopbacks that as you look into the different objectives, you maybe get better in defining the problem overall. And especially in terms of the next step, the alternatives, so after P and R for problem and O for objectives, we get to A for alternatives. And these are basically the different choices you have. Yeah, so it could be staying with your current job, trying to get a new job within your company, switching to another job, or, you know, maybe becoming a freelancer. So there's different options here. And in regulatory review, it could be that you have approval, rejection, approval with conditions, these kind of things. Yeah,
more than just one choice that you can take after that. So there are alternatives, and that is something that you need to consider. You need to just keep in mind also when moving forward. So what is the, you know, what are the potential or the actual alternatives, and don't focus on one, because, you know, you may not even know what the alternatives are. So just consider this as an extra step to think about what the realistic alternatives could be.
The trap which we discussed earlier is that you get presented one alternative, and then you structure your problem around this alternative rather than to understand it completely and more holistically. The next step is then quite easy, so to say.
The C stands for consequences. So basically this brings in that, you know, once the decision of moving forward is then, you know, to work with the consequences.
If you think of a matrix with all the alternatives being the columns and the objectives being the rows, you can fill in these cells with the consequences. Yeah. So if you take this treatment, then you get this amount of benefit and this number of side effects. And you have this cost, and it comes with this frequency of administration or whatever, yeah? So these are also different things. And in a job, it could be kind of, okay, with going with this new job offer, you have 30 minutes of commute, you get that salary, and so on.
Yeah, that's what we usually call the pro and cons for each of the, you know, alternatives. So what we say, so that you just kind of make a matrix of comparing, to have it visualized as well. I mean, sometimes you don't need a matrix in a way of writing it down, but actually it does help if you just visualize it for yourself or for the audience or whatever you present, is to really go through and see that's the alternatives, and this is, you know, the objectives, and this is what it means, yeah. The consequence for it. So it's really very nice also visualization for moving forward and work together.
In benefit risk, this is called the effects table, and it really helps you to understand all the data that is really important for making a decision. The next step is, now it gets more tricky, because sometimes you have, of course, you look into this effects table and you see, okay, treatment A is better in all aspects compared to treatment B. It's more efficacious and it's safer, and then off you go. You have an alternative that dominates everything else, then that's easy. You move forward with that. Or you have maybe alternatives that are dominated by something else. So there, you know, whatever you do, you'll always be worse off with this alternative. Then you can, you know, already eliminate these kind of things. Yeah.
Or like for the going back to the job example, you know, if you're really keen on getting the money in, then that's an easy trick. I mean, to just decide on the money rather than on the content. So that is something really, sometimes it's quite clear. You have a very, very strong purpose of, you know, what the reason for the whole discussion is. I mean, that's going back to the problem. So if you start the discussion about the job is that you don't have enough money, then it might dominate it more than when you think you're getting bored and you don't have enough, you don't have enough opportunities to develop further. So that is something completely different to what the problem really is. And so therefore the trade-offs are quite dominated from all the background that you brought in the very first step in identifying the problem.
Then you may realize already that certain objectives that you had in the beginning are maybe not that relevant. Yeah, you had them at the beginning, but maybe all the consequences for all these are very, very similar and doesn't really add so much to the decision. That could be the case. But where it really gets interesting, of course, is if you have these problems that some things point into one direction, some things point into the other direction. Yeah, so you have treatment that is very effective, but also less safe compared to another treatment. What do you do about it? There you can, you need to make a trade-off, or you have a job where, you need to commute twice as long as with your original job, but you get 10K more in terms of money. Is it worth it? For our decision, it may make sense to give all these different outcomes some monetary value or some other value, some units that you can measure against all these different things. Sometimes one of the alternatives is that unit. Yeah? So you can say, okay, to get that additional benefit, how much would I trade something else? So, for example, how much increase in safety or in the side effect I would tolerate to get that added benefit?
That's good. I mean, if it works, because sometimes, especially for the benefits or the safety, it's quite difficult to have. But what I first thought when I read about the trade-offs is I think this is the point really where the discussion, are usually starting very loud. So, for example, when you have these spread between efficacy and safety, you definitely need to bring in people to better understand or to better explain or just to monetize the whole discussion, because this might get out of hand. This is then really the complex and the tricky part where we need to find a solution, but probably not alone, depending on the topic. I mean, if it's something very personal, then obviously it's probably for yourself, but if it's about business, then you need to bring in some people that can assist in identifying. So what does it really mean to have less safety or less safe drugs? Is it just that you have more side effects, or do you have more serious side effects, or what actually is it? What you're expecting? So kind of to make the team or the decision makers understood what it really means.
Yeah, and there is a whole big research area in this. That is all about this preference research. Mm-hmm. So if you have attended one of the last PSI conferences, and there was usually something about patient preference studies. And this is where that gets in. And there's lots of different ways you can assess these preferences. There's swing weighting. There's this whole way of discrete choice elements. And I don't want to go too much into detail. Just go back a couple of episodes where we talked about patient preferences with experts in that area. So there's episodes with Sherul, there's episodes with Marco Burley, and some other episodes about benefit risk. And in these areas, we talk a lot about patient preferences. This is a step where that comes in. The next step is really, really important for us as statisticians, and that is the U for uncertainty. Of course, there's, if you go to the job example, you have a couple of things that are certain. You have, your current salary, you have your future salary that is in the contract that you have in there. But what about the career prospects? What about whether you will increase your salary in the future? There's, of course, much more uncertainty. Yeah? Mm-hmm. There is your commuting time is probably also rather certain, but maybe there's other things in there that, whether you can work with your new colleagues or your new supervisor. Well, you have pretty much of a certainty in terms of your current supervisor, but what happens if you switch? Yeah, there you have much more uncertainty, and uncertainty should lead to a lower weight of that outcome in the overall decision making. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if you're uncertain about it, you basically don't know, And you should make decisions on what you don't know or what you can't.
To be honest, I think this is quite natural to everyone. So if you don't know, you don't know. So basically, you don't decide. It is sometimes this is more like a, for me, that sounds more like a reminder to remember that there are some of the elements that we discussed or that you consider as an objective that are not certain, even though they sound like it. So, for example, you know, you may know what if you have an interview and ask questions, they will sell it. Definitely. So many ways of moving forward in the company to develop and to train and to get things and everything. So yes, you do probably, but you know, at the end, you don't know yet because you haven't received it. You haven't seen it. And I think that is the point where also with the colleagues, you may know one of them or two, and they're fond of it. They like their job. And so you're happy that you joined the team, but actually you may not even see them at all because they're just working on different component or whatsoever. So it's something, there are so many uncertainties that you should always kind of find these to take time for this step to really think, do I know this? Is this certain? Is this guaranteed like a salary, or is this really like uncertain? So do you, and that is not only about a job. This is basically about every decision that we try to do is that we sometimes move along with things that you think you know, but you don't. So take your time and reconsider the thinking about the different objectives in terms of, certainty, because only then if you weight them correctly. So, and as Alexander said, the lower weight them lower. If there the uncertainty is higher, then you can make a good decision.
And in terms of, you know, benefit risk, that could be that you're pretty certain in terms of your benefit profile because you have sufficient number of patients to clearly assess that, but you're rather uncertain in terms of certain side effects. Yeah, and of course there's a risk in this, you know, just looking into this effects table with just the point estimates in there and not seeing how wide the confidence intervals are. And it could, of course, be that the data that you have for certain aspects, it has a much bigger and broader evidence base than for other aspects. So you need to take that into account. What sometimes is done to model this uncertainty is to do some scenario planning. Yeah, so you run a base case, a successful case, and a, you know, worst outcome situation to get a sense of, okay, if we move forward with these different alternatives, where might we end up? Yeah. So if you put for one alternative all the worst case scenario and for another one's best case scenario, switch it around, does that help you to get a better sense of what might happen? And is there something that where you get a red flag? Okay, if this happens, then that's really, really bad. Yeah. And what's the probability of that happening? That's really important to have a look into.
Yeah, I think the scenario planning is a very, very good approach. We have just to remember that this needs to be done still objective, and we can kind of, you know, turn our screws a little bit like we want to see the results. So when we are not stupid, usually you understand when you put in more like a higher weight on this one and extra high weight on that one, that might be just, you know, looking very, very good. So that's something we need to be very careful about. So, you know, try to, you know, focus on your objective weights rather than, you know, putting the different scenarios in a one, the, you know, to identify one that you favor and then kind of make it happen. So that's something, yeah.
All these kind of things will help you to structure your decision and to make your argumentation more explicit. So that you don't have these underlying feelings and gut feelings and things like that, but rather that you can verbalize and communicate these different topics.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Mm.
And that you can separate it from each other. Because one of the problems that you very often get in these discussions is that people jump forward and backwards, and you don't have a structured approach, and you're not talking about the same thing. Yeah, and so structuring it in this way helps you to focus at one point at a time and get that solved before you move on to the next one. Yeah.
Yeah. Before we move, I think that's a very, very good point what you mentioned about the basically a documentation or like the how to present this at the end. We didn't mention it before, but some of the steps are really, really quite important to be nicely put into a slide as well, in case you are asked to show or to say what's the decision that you took. Why is it the decision that you at the end took? So I think putting this into a nice structure and planning the scenarios, doing the matrix and so that will definitely help to not only make the right decision, but also to justify and to sell your decision to the audience, to the people that are even, you know, sometimes need to sign in for the decision.
Yeah. But when you present a recommendation, you can show how you came to that recommendation. And this is also one of the areas why regulators are so interested in this approach, because that helps them to sell their decisions and to be transparent with how they get to a decision. And that is something that is important for them, but it's also important for you, because you may be challenged later on, oh, did you make the right decision? That study was a failure. But then you can document, okay, we went through this process. We looked into all these different alternatives. We had that knowledge at the time, and that's what we based our decision on. Yeah. So you can also defend yourself internally. And if you have changes in your study team, you can also make sure that people get on board much quicker, because you have all this written down and you can run people through and say, that's what we already decided, this is what we already decided, and you don't come back to the same decision a couple of years ago again or a couple of months ago again just because you have a new physician on the team or a new statistician on the team or a new one from regulatory science on the team.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really great for that purpose as well. The next step number 7 with the R, it stands for risk tolerance. And risk tolerance is really interesting topic in itself. It comes a little bit also with how we approach changes overall and whether we are going for something new and riskier because there is a huge gain to be reached, or whether we are more the conservative person that play it safe and where, you know, any risk is really, really important. And we see that even in the medical community. Yeah, there's certain areas where people are just used to taking risks. Yeah, because they know they have life-threatening diseases and therefore they are willing to take quite high risks. And then there's other areas where the overall disease landscape is not that life-threatening, yeah. And then people have a much higher sensitivity for risks. And I'm just thinking about dermatologists, for example. Many, many dermatologists are just used to prescribing topical treatment, and they are afraid to prescribe anything that is systemic, like injectables or pills or something like this, because they associate that with all kind of different side effects you can have, and then just not used to manage these side effects like other physicians are. If you think about oncology on the other end of the spectrum, the side effects they deal with are really, really serious, but they are willing to take the risk because they know the life of the patient is on the line. And they are used to taking these risks.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult because you can't really fit them for all in this step. because often, you know, you have a wide range of patients, let's say. So yeah. Some of them are more, you would take the risk. Others say, well, no, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
So, and then, but you have to serve them all. And that is something that's a very tricky point. So that you have to balance the risk and the tolerance then really out for everyone. And it's difficult.
But sometimes it's really surprising. There's an interesting obesity example where the FDA interviewed patients about different therapies for obesity. And there were therapies that were very, very invasive and came with a pretty high safety burden. Yet the patients preferred these because they saw the big, big gain in terms of the efficacy side.
Mm.
The regulators initially were really concerned about all the safety things, but the patients, I'm even willing to put my life on the line here because life as it's now is so, so terrible. Yeah, and we are not talking about here patients with a BMI of 30. Yeah, so these were quite obese patients. Yeah, and they have tried everything, and they were willing to assume quite a high risk for the safety side to get the benefit. It's the same with stakeholders internally. Yeah, so you may have stakeholders that make the decision whether that's a you know. A committee or whether that's an internal individual person who is very risk tolerant or someone that is really looking for innovation and trying to push the envelopes there. So understanding that risk profile is really important. It can move you into different directions depending on what your risk profile is. But that's a quite difficult concept.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's something still we need to consider. And also the last one is quite difficult. And I think it's also one that usually isn't very much considered at all. The last one is with an L. So it's linked decisions. So basically to answer the question, how will future decisions affected by the decision that you are making?
Yeah.
So what does it have? That is difficult in many ways. It's especially in a way that you don't even know what other decisions are out there.
Yeah.
So this is about being informed, and putting in the right or getting the right people together, or maybe just to check in with some people. So where you see could be have a potential impact. And also this may potentially add quite a bit of a complexity, because if you make your decision dependent on other decisions or future decisions, that is something that is just about complexity of really taking a decision for yourself.
Here it's kind of surfaces what are all the other things we need to take into account in the future. So for example, if we move forward with this big study, that will limit lots of other decisions in the future because
resources.
we have spent the budget and spent the resources. Yeah. I think that's a really important point, but because very often we see our decisions in isolations. Yeah. Do we invest our time in this project, for example? Yeah. Do we want to write this paper? Do we want to give this presentation at a conference? These kind of things. But then we just think, yeah, that would be nice to do. But if we say yes to this, we need to say no to future opportunities. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what is the likelihood that we may get another great offer down the line that we then need to decline because we have went for this paper or this presentation? That's always something to have in mind, because that also puts things in perspective.
Yeah. No, but I think this is what everyone has come across already, that you made a decision and then realizing later on, well, yes, it did have an impact on the future in a way. So in my future or my future decisions.
So now we went through 8 different steps to give you more efficiency, clarity, consistency and speed in your decision making, and these will help you to get alignment within your organization, within your study team, and will help you also to clearly communicate what you are doing, whether that is within your study team or whether that is to stakeholders. It helps you for your personal life as well as for your professional life. And these 8 steps were, first, understanding clearly the problem. Second, having all the objectives, the outcomes that you want to get to clear. Then, what are the different choices, the alternatives you have? And then you can fill in the matrix of the alternatives with the objectives with all the consequences. Then you can look into the trade-offs and eliminate the different alternatives that you have. You can look into the uncertainty to see whether there's, you know, certain things that should be of lower weight because they are, have a higher uncertainty. You can use scenario planning to move forward there. The next step is then to look into your or the stakeholders' risk tolerance for that. So we talked there a little bit about the patient or whether you have certain governance bodies that are very risk averse or really innovative driven. And then the last part was about the linked decisions.
Very well. That helps us for some decision. And one decision is we make is that we now come to an end of our talk today without a matrix. just time off. Excellent. Thanks. It's very, very interesting and very good. I think this does help every one of us to really get to do the right decision and to do them efficiently. I think this is something that we sometimes lack in many ways, and that really should help us to do an efficient decision and the right decision at one point.
Yeah, and if you want to learn more about it, I can highly recommend the book Smart Choices, and you can find that in the show notes. So stay tuned.
Have a nice day.
Talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain, who helps with the show in the background. And thank you for listening. Please visit TheEffectiveStatistician.com to find the show notes and learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. One last thing. Please tell your colleagues about this podcast if you like it, so that more people can benefit from it, and that you have someone else to talk about the content and to implement different ideas that we present here in the podcast. So, like always, reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.